This is 16.9, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. We're all about digital signage and have been since 2006. We cover what's interesting now and what will be interesting and important one day soon. And we filter out all the BS. This podcast is a chance to add depth and color to what we do online, and it gives smart people a chance to really talk about their companies and their ideas. You can hear new episodes weekly on your smartphone, tablet, or desktop, free of charge. 16.9 is sponsored and supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful, ready-made, auto-delivered, and auto-updated content for screens. Fantastic Creative is at the heart of any great digital signage project. And when I'm asked to rattle off the names of creative shops capable of doing top-level work, Moment Factory is automatically in there. The Montreal-based creative technology group has evolved from a small collective doing VJing and just basically having fun doing cool stuff, to arguably being the premier multimedia shop on the planet for jobs that involve big screens and projections. They're the guys who projection mapped the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. That's their work in the LAX International Terminal and at Singapore's Changi Airport. Moment Factory did the reasonably modest but awesome ceiling display in Oakley's flagship store in New York. Moment does digital signage, but they also do live shows on cruise ships, they light up bridges, and they even design multi-purpose media systems for stadiums. Saki Bissett, Moment's creative director and one of the founders, was kind enough to take a few minutes from his crazy work days to talk about a company that now has 250 people and offices all over the world. He also talks about the thinking behind all that great work. So Saki, thank you very much for taking the time with me. I wasn't really aware of Moment Factory until I'd say 2012 when you guys did the projection mapping job on Madonna's halftime show at the Super Bowl. Was that kind of a big moment for the company?
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely a big moment. There's been quite a few great moments. We were really lucky to have had worked with such great people and such amazing people have trusted us with these quite ambitious and crazy projects. But yeah, there's been a few of these kinds of breakthroughs, yeah.
Was that the one that sort of put you on the map, so to speak, and generated a lot more business? Or were things already kind of moving for you?
Things were moving, but there was definitely a big step. I think a lot of people heard about it. A lot of people had seen our work. What was very interesting for that is that a lot of people, especially in the US and in Canada, you know, we could refer to that project. Oh, have you seen that show, the halftime show with Madonna? And they say, oh, yeah, we saw that. So then it's like, oh, yeah, that's our work, you know, the projection mapping on there. So that was kind of like a good way to for us to refer to our work. Like, what do you guys do? Well, stuff like that. Because sometimes it's hard to describe what we do if people don't know it, especially at the beginning because the industry was so new. Mm-hmm. You know, when we started in 2001, video projections and LEDs were barely existing. There was no mobile phones or there was no smartphones, that's for sure. So, you know, the whole technology world and the whole multimedia industry was barely existing, if at all, you know.
So going back to 2001, then if a lot of that stuff wasn't around, what was kind of the charter for the company at that point? What were you there to do?
Well, it was a very organic beginning. I started out, I was doing a lot of photography and I was doing basically like slideshows and 16 millimeter loops in raves and after hour parties. And then there was kind of like this digital shift that happened. And basically, from one day to another, you know, you could shoot on mini DV and you could edit on computers. And then you could play back on like video projectors that were like, I don't know, the size of a Ski-Doo for like 1,000 lumens. So you know, then like we started VJing in nightclubs and after hour parties. And from one thing to another, we got together. And basically, I rented this loft. A friend of mine was leaving his loft and I rented it and I was like, oh yeah, okay, I'll rent it, I'll take it. I had no clue what I was going to do there and why I was taking this thing. I was like, okay, it sounds like fun, you know. Couldn't afford it. So then my friends came in and we started like, you know, renting desks out to friends and people that we would collaborate with. And then, you know, got together with two partners, Dominic O'Day and Jason Rohde. In those days, he was also a partner and we put together Moment Factory and we just started doing like more corporate events and stuff like that with the same approach as VJing. So like playing with different types of storytellings and visual kind of impactful images that was kind of like the new medium would basically inform the type of content that you could produce you know. And then we started doing stuff with Cirque du Soleil. We met Alain Vinet from in some after-hours parties. That basically he was a DJ, and he was a DJ also for Guy Liberté's parties, because in those days Guy was doing a lot of parties. And then we started doing parties with Guy, and then we got along with those guys, and then we started doing more permanent stuff with Cirque du Soleil, and then so a lot of that just grew from this very organic thing. And basically the strategy was like no strategy at all. It's like, what's the most fun thing to do right now, you know? What's the most amazing thing we can do? And we like, you know, be working like for a week for like $100, you know, at three people. So it would be like a lot of work, but it was so much fun, you know. It felt like we were part of something new, part of a revolution, part of like a new medium. And since then, you know, the industry has changed a lot, and it became an actual career. Like, people can make a living out of this now, you know, which before, or not even just a living, like actually a career. You can grow within this industry and, you know, do a whole bunch of different things. And, you know, we were lucky enough to be at the beginning of the industry and to have had people trust us in our projects and with crazy, you know, ambitions, and to trust us into doing stuff that was pushing the limits. And we've managed to pull off a few projects, I think, that are standards in the industry, or that were standards in the industry. One of them that comes to mind is the Nine Inch Nails Lights in the Sky show with Trent Reznor and Roy Bennett and Rob Sheridan and these guys that pulled together this show. It was a really landmark show, I think, in those days, with like interactivity on stage and all that. That was definitely a big step. You know, the Super Bowl was another good step. LAX was another big step. You know, there's been a lot of the forests that we've been doing lately have been a good step. So there's been a lot of different things. But what's interesting, what I feel really lucky with as well, is the fact that we play in a variety of different industries within the multimedia industry, you know.
Yeah, you certainly do. Was there a big moment? I keep going back to moment, but it's a good name.
Sure.
Was there a job or something that you guys did where you kind of looked at each other and went, oh, now this is serious?
Yeah, at a certain point, you know, Dominic, my partner, was doing a full-time job. He still had a full-time job at the Planetarium. And he was doing also like corporate events on the side and basically doing Moment Factory with us. And then at a certain point, we had done like a few shows, a few like parties with Guy Liberté and Jean-François Bouchard at Cirque du Soleil. And then they asked us to work on this cruise ship, a cruise ship basically with Royal Caribbean. Was it Royal Caribbean? No, it was Celebrity Cruise. And then it was like, okay, Dom, you need to quit your job. We need to focus on this properly. You know, it's a big permanent thing. It's like a small show within the cruise ship. And it was like, we had to like design all the video for it and all that. And so that was kind of like the moment was like, okay, now it's becoming a job. You know, it's not just like the most fun thing we can do right now.
And you break the business into two parts. You've got shows and you've got
destinations.
Do you run the business that way as well? Are they separate business units, or is everything kind of intermingled?
Well, right now we're actually in the process of restructuring the studio. And what we're doing is we're focusing on markets. And we're going to have specialized teams dedicated to specific markets. Some of the markets are like rock shows or concerts and shows. Some of them are like the theme park industry. Some of them are branding and events, you know, like brand experiences. Some of them are urban spaces, airports and bridges and stuff like that. So all of these different specialized units are going to be dedicated to each of their industries. And in the past, we've had basically pools of talent that we would put together for each project, which was working really well up till now. But I think this will help focus and really have the teams that are dedicated to these industries will help focus and push things further and deeper.
I would imagine that's because the clients in each of those categories can be quite different.
It is very different. Like when you're dealing in a rock show industry, if you send an email that's more than two lines, no one reads. And when you're dealing with architects and engineers, when you're designing a bridge, if you're not sending an email that has like, you know, three scroll downs, you know, they're like, what's going on with these guys? They're not deep, you know, they're not thorough. So the language and the way these industries work is very different. And also with the studio that grew so much, you know, now there's 250 people or more here in Montreal. And it just becomes like the sense that the efforts are dissolved, you know, and, you know, it's based on passion and based on like dedication. This is like, you know, it's not a mechanical job, you know, we need to figure stuff out. We need to innovate. We need to push the limits and that requires dedication. And sometimes it's much easier to do that when you're working with the same people on a regular basis. So there's this collaborative trust dynamic going on. You don't have to learn to work with new people inside the studio. And also it just makes it feel like our efforts are all going to make a bigger difference. And that's very focusing and motivating.
How much of the company is in Montreal?
I would say 95%.
Okay.
We have studios in LA, New York, Paris, London, Tokyo, and some more to come in Asia shortly. But those are all small studios. Mm-hmm. So it's like Paris has maybe 15, 20 people approximately. And the other ones are quite small, like 2, 3, 4 people.
Right. What is it? I've asked this before of other people. What is it about Montreal and creative work that makes it so different and so good?
I think there's a mix of different things. You know, I think there's a cultural thing, the fact that there's a cultural mix here from the European mix with the American, North American mix. I think that it helps to kind of create this different flavor. I think also the fact that there's a French island within North America's culture also makes it like people need to push differently and to push harder and to do things a little bit differently. But it also comes maybe with an open-mindedness. So I think there's a lot of different things that make it very unique. You know, it has a different culture. It's a different city. It's a different place. So it does create a different mix. I think also like throughout the years, there's been multiple different industries that have grown in Montreal, whether it's the cirque industry, the video game, the film industry, the multimedia industry, and the government had supported also with tax credits and all kinds of initiatives through many years, all of these different industries in different ways. And that has definitely been also a factor, I think, in being able to take different risks, being able to have a certain support to develop and to look at things differently a little bit. And I think all of these elements coming together makes a big difference.
Are you still seeing a healthy amount of talent coming out of the schools there? You can find the people you need for your business?
Oh, it's always been difficult. I mean, that still is the most difficult thing in our business. You know, the projects are super complex. There's a lot of complicated things in creating innovative, industry-changing projects. But definitely attracting talent is the most difficult. Although it's changed a lot, you know. At the beginning, no one knew what this industry was, you know, and wasn't existing. And we had people that were much more multidisciplinary. Now, because the projects are getting more complex, it seems that more and more people are specialized. So there's more people on each project, but they can go deeper. They understand things in a much more deep way. For example, we used to have generalist motion designers only, very good motion designers, but now we have all kinds of 3D specialists and 3D pipelines, and they can go really deep into like really high quality content. Same with interactive technology, same with the technical directors, and same with the directors. Everyone's getting much more specialized and much more deep into their expertise. And you know, now I feel like there's other places that people have gained experience in. At the beginning, we had to train people from zero pretty much. Now it feels like people, like we hire people from everywhere in the world. We do a lot of work permits, and we hire people from Asia, from Europe, from South America, from the US. And I could see a lot more and more talent coming from other companies that have been doing stuff like us. So it's reassuring somehow, you know, to know that this is becoming a real industry, that people are making a living out of this, you know, making a career.
So is your company starting to be an aspiration for people who, you know, they'll start with a smaller group, but this is where they want to be ultimately?
Sometimes, you know, sometimes some people want to come through to the studio because we've done a lot of notoriety, like strong projects that have created notoriety in this industry. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, people are following us. And I think it's kind of like part of our responsibility and part of the responsibility of a lot of the, or all of the studios that are doing cool stuff in this new industry. When a project is successful, it helps the whole industry. When a project is not successful, it hurts the industry. For example, like if we look at LAX, mm-hmm. the LAX project that we did, I think it was in 2012 possibly. Basically, that project, I think, has inspired a lot of other multimedia projects around the world, whether we were asked to do them or other people were asked to do them. But because it was a successful project, because the technology was really well integrated to the architecture, because the content was well integrated to the architecture and it made a lot of sense, and it made a big impact in the airport industry, in the retail industry, in the casino industry, et cetera. And this, you know, pushes more people to invest into these kind of infrastructures and these kinds of projects. And if the project was not successful, they would not have done that. And when people see projects kind of like badly executed, or that the technology is not strong or their content is not strong, they wonder like, oh yeah, I don't want to do that. That's not the right thing for us, you know? So I think it's everyone's responsibility to do great work.
It takes time and real money to make and host this podcast, so I'm grateful for the continuing support of ScreenFeed.
Hi, this is Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. I hope you're enjoying the podcast as much as I am. I've loved Dave's blog since we started in the industry. It's now our 10th year at ScreenFeed, and we've grown to be a reliable partner for the industry, serving over 1,700 customers with over 100,000 screens globally, and we're currently getting 10 million content requests daily. But more important than that is that we make content beautiful, functional for the medium, and we help our customers meet their goals of increasing viewership and satisfying customers. If you don't know how ScreenFeed can help you, it's worth 5 minutes to browse our website or give us a call. If you're out walking your dog, driving home, or relaxing on your favorite chair, just make a mental note to check us out. Now back to the podcast.
Is it a challenge when you do something like the Bradley Terminal at LAX and you have prospective clients who come to you and say, yeah, what you did there, I want that for my shopping mall or whatever. And then you explain to them what kind of costs are involved, not only on the technology, but more so in terms of original creative and keeping that creative fresh. Does that tend to chase a lot of people off? We just don't understand how much is involved?
Sometimes, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of different levels to this. And there's one thing that's definitely the cost. And the costs can be quite prohibitive for a lot of clients, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a big investment. And then some people try to balance out the cost with revenue. And they think like, okay, how much money can I make with these screens, you know, mm-hmm. by putting advertisement or branding on them. And sometimes it's a good idea. Sometimes it makes sense for them to do that. But sometimes it doesn't necessarily make sense to do that. You know, it devalues the installation, but sometimes it makes a lot of sense. But the projects sometimes are bigger than just the cost also, because you need to make it happen. And their organization needs to be able to support the process or to have enough trust within the organization to be able to delegate the responsibility of supporting this process. And I think that's where we come in now with more and more expertise, is our capacity to guide our clients into making the right decisions and to putting the right amount of money in the right place in order to make the best possible project for their venues, you know. And sometimes it's about the cost, but sometimes it's also about the organization's capacity to support the project, also about the operations, also about, you know, the procurement. So there's a lot of different elements that need to come together, but the cost is definitely the one that's the most black and white at the beginning to say go, no go. You know, it's a pretty obvious thing to look at.
So for something like the shopping malls that your company's been working on in South Korea, looks like that would have had a monetization model right out of the gate. Is that easier when you just know that these screens somehow have to also make some money?
I think so. I think it needs to be part of the strategy. If the clients are looking to make money with the screens, it needs to be part of the initial strategy, and it needs to be part of the content strategy. And We need to design the infrastructure, the system and the hardware in order to be able to a variety of different revenue models. Some clients like the Changi Airport, for example, in Singapore, they're not looking to monetize the screens. For them, it's art, and for them, it's value to have entertainment for their passengers. And so it really depends. And sometimes it's a good thing to try to monetize, and sometimes I don't think it's a good thing. You know, sometimes it's like I describe it like, you know, if you made an airport and you build this huge atrium in glass and it's a stunning atrium, well, it creates an identity for that airport. But people are not trying to monetize the glass.
Yeah.
You know, it's an architectural statement. And sometimes multimedia should be an architectural statement. And it should not be tried to be polluted by a whole different intention. But sometimes it can fit very well, and it can balance out revenue and can make the value of the piece much stronger because you have a different capacity to invest into more content or to, it depends on the organization. It depends on the site, depends on the objectives of the site. You know, airports somehow are very different than shopping centers or casinos or public spaces. You know, they have a different mandate in the city. Mm-hmm. They're there to also be part of the landmarks and the branding of a city. And if you have too much only advertisement in these contexts, at a certain point, you know, that's what you remember from the city.
Yeah, I in certain respects, think about these big digital spectaculars as the new version of water fountains that you would find in a lobby.
Yeah.
It's that kind of an investment.
It is that kind of investment. And maybe sometimes it should be mixed with a fountain, and sometimes it should be mixed with other elements, you know. But in the end, you're not necessarily always trying to monetize the fountain. The fountain was made to as an art piece, as a feature of, you know, like a garden.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to monetize the garden. Maybe you get a sponsor and it becomes this specific brand's garden, which you can do also with this multimedia technology, you know. So there's a lot of different things, and the industry is quite new.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that are being tried out, and I think we've figured out a lot of ways to program and to structure these models. For example, even in some projects, we finance our clients. So what we do is we kind of lease the equipment to them for a 10-year plan. And the big advantage of that is us being around for 10 years for them, with them, you know, on a strategic approach of like, how do we manage this equipment? How do we manage your investment? How do we operate your systems, our systems for the next 10 years? And it just changes the equation and the reality and the dynamic between us and our partners, you know.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite projects that you guys have done is probably one of the most modest ones that you've done. I always have liked the Oakley flagship store in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm curious that would have been, I would imagine, one of your first pure digital signage projects. I'm curious what was the thinking behind that and how you arrived at what's in there.
Yeah, that was a very interesting project. I mean, there's a lot of challenges and, you know, the scale of it, a flagship store, Fifth Avenue, it's not a very big square footage. And basically, Oakley approached us to create something in there that was touching, memorable, impactful, that would draw people inside the store, but that would not touch too much square feet and that would not affect the displaying of the merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely automatically looked at the ceiling. And what we looked at is to play with the angles of views and parallax of like being in a certain position. When you're outside the store, you see like this whole composition. When you're inside the store and you walk through, the way the screens are broken up, you start seeing just parts of the content, and it kind of breaks itself out and breaks up, you know. And that's it's an interesting layout. I think the way the screens are integrated to the ceiling and into the store,
mm-hmm.
aesthetically, it really connects with the rest of the aesthetic of the store, which makes it feel like seamlessly, it has a home there. It's not a random piece, which sometimes can happen.
Oh, yeah. Because fine pitch LED is coming down in cost and is becoming a lot more prevalent, I'm seeing more and more flagship stores that are putting very large video walls, on the feature wall of their store or in behind the sales counter, that kind of thing. What do you think of that stuff? Because in many cases, it seems like they've led with the technology and said, we're going to put a big video wall there. And then somebody after the fact says, okay, what are we going to put on here?
Well, that's what happens a lot. Huh? Me, I describe that saying like, oh, you know what? I would like to make a house. I would like to build a house. And I would like it to be a brick house. So I'm going to go see a brick manufacturer and and he's going to help me design a house. Yeah. You know, what he's going to do is going to sell you the bricks with his best intention in the world. But in the end, I'm not sure you're going to have the right windows at the right place or are you going to have a door to get into the house, mm-hmm. you know, and how's the house functioning as far as like, why do you need the house and where the kitchen should be and how many rooms do you need and what's your family and what's the future and how does it connect to the neighborhood, you know, and all of these questions I think are fundamental questions and they need to be seen as a holistic ecosystem and from conception to the reason and the connection with the architecture to the operations and everything that comes in between, you know, and how is this going to be used in the future mm-hmm. and what does it need to be able to do in 5 years? So all of these different elements need to come together and we see like multimedia infrastructure as an ecosystem. And from this ecosystem, people we try to create the strongest experience possible for the audience. You know, the audience can be a shopper, the audience can be a traveler, the audience can be, you know, a fan from a show. But in the end, the context should inform the physicality, the physical manifestation of this, and the content strategy. What type of content do we want to create for here? What makes the most sense, you know, and how do you scale it out budget wise? Because mm-hmm. these contents are very expensive. So sometimes you can create content for a longer period of time. So like 15-minute thing for much cheaper than another type of content. So you kind of mix this up so you can fill up the library of content with a variety of pieces that really fit with either different times of day or different programmings that you need to do on in this site, mm-hmm. you know. So it requires a lot of flexibility and a lot of strategy to be able to connect all these dots together. And when you just come from a technology angle or you just come from a system angle, you're not seeing all of these things. But through the years, you know, we felt that our clients and our projects needed this 360 kind of more turnkey headspace and strategy. Mm-hmm. So we developed the expertise in-house to do that. And from this comes up more of a holistic point of view, a holistic angle on creating these environments. Mm-hmm.
One of the ways that some companies at least have got around the challenge of keeping the content fresh and the cost that can be involved is using generative data to kind of drive a video display and drive the artwork on there. I'm curious what you think of that from the lens of some of the stuff I've seen looks amazing, but I don't know what I'm looking at. Is it important that people understand what they're seeing or can it just be motion art?
Yeah, I think, again, it depends on the objectives and the purpose, and it depends on what kind of library of content you want to create. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes a very abstract expression can be very suited for a building and or an entrance, a lobby, an airport, whatever. But sometimes it's not, you know, and sometimes it does within a library of content where some things are very precise and figurative and some things are very abstract. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that mix is important, you know. For me, it's not because it's generative and it theoretically it's ever changing, it's never really the same at all, that it for a common audience it doesn't look the same. Because, mm-hmm. you know, at a certain point, if you have like white lines and a blue background, and they're always a little bit different. The white lines and the blue background, they're always a little bit different, but for the general audience, they look the same.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah, for me, it's interesting. I think all of the generative stuff is becoming more and more accessible today. And it's very interesting as a creative format and as an outlet, and it has a lot of potential, but I wouldn't necessarily say the biggest value of it is to have more variety. I think it's a technique in itself, and it's conceptually very interesting also to be able to feed. So it feels like it's alive, mm-hmm. and it feels like there's intelligence between the walls, inside the walls, and how do you feel about like the data driving the content and what does that mean conceptually? I think that starts to be interesting. And then how do you, where does it come from and what is it, how does it execute as far as aesthetics? I think are very good reasons to use this type of content just to create more variety. Sometimes it can. Mm-hmm. If you have different parameters, that'll change the color, change the shapes, change the variety, but often it's similar.
Mm-hmm. One of your most recent projects is just down the highway from you in Ottawa at the National Arts Center.
Yes.
Is that the first time you've worked with transparent LED?
We've worked in more like show environments with transparent LED. Okay. We've done a bunch of that with Nine Inch Nails at the time with Roy Bennett and Rob Sheridan and Trent. Maybe that was in 2008 or something like that. But on an architectural piece, I don't remember another time that we worked with transparent LED. I think it's an interesting medium. I think, you know, it has its challenges and it has its advantages. You know, I think it works quite well in this context. I think it's a nice execution. The lighthouse, the beacon, it's quite well, it turned out quite well. We're quite happy with it.
One other thing that struck me in just kind of watching your social media feed is you guys are now, I don't know that you are the architects, but you're directly involved in building venues. I'm thinking of the one in Paris.
Yes. Basically, what we're doing in Paris is we're designing the multimedia infrastructure for an arena. So it's a 40,000 people arena. And basically what we did is we designed a system that has about 25 projectors, video projectors, and they're based with mirror systems. And the mirror system lines up the projections onto the floor, so onto the grass of the stadium. It's a rugby stadium, so there's like grass on the field.
Uh-huh.
And it does the similar effect as we did for Madonna's Super Bowl on the grass. Mm-hmm. And then these mirrors recalibrate automatically to become massive screens also to be able to see the game, to get all the data from the game and to support the game when the game is playing.
Huh.
So it's really, and then it's all synchronized with the lighting and with the ring of LED around. So it's like basically seeing arenas as a whole ecosystem of multimedia technology that's really linked together. So we can support all kinds of different events and shows within this venue. So it's not the architecture element of it. It's really the multimedia right. element. But it's really more of a holistic view on multimedia. And it's how do we see these venues being used in the future? And what's the potential of the future of arenas and stadiums?
Right. So just like the way an arena is designed to have flexible seating for different kinds of events, you've done the same thing for the multimedia piece.
Yes, exactly.
Huh.
And we're operating this. So we have a 10-year contract with the owner of the arena so that we're operating it. So we have a team there operating every game and every show.
Hence having 15 people in Paris.
Hence having 15 people in Paris, yes.
Last question. What are you working or what is Moment Factory working on right now that you're allowed to talk about that will get people excited?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different projects. We're doing some casinos in France. We're doing a really interesting show in New York. We're doing a bunch of stuff in Singapore, a bunch of stuff in Japan. It seems like Asia is picking up a lot and there's a lot of different projects and a lot of different opportunities. We just finished the bridge here in Montreal this summer, so that was quite an interesting infrastructure project and quite a complex project to bring home. So that was quite fun. Probably some more bridges coming along as well. There's also the forests that we've been pushing a lot and that people have been really interested in. So you know, as I was saying, there's a big variety of industries that we tap into, and that's super exciting for us to be able to mix these different things together and kind of find a way to really impact each of these different industries in different ways.
Huh. Saki, it's been a pleasure to hear about your company.
Yes. Thanks so much for your time, and thanks for reaching out, Dave, for the interview. It's really nice to connect with you.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net, every day. If you like this podcast, please also check out the companion 16.9 podcast called Projects. That's done by Michael Tutton, and there's a new episode every second Friday. 69 The Blog and now the podcast are properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.